the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Martin Dillon is a veteran of reporting on the North and has broken many exclusive stories over the years. He has returned to the topic with the book The Sorrow and the Loss, which tells the tragic shadow cast by the Troubles on the lives of women. Martin Dillon, thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Nice to be with you.
Why did you decide that you wanted to focus on this particular angle so many years after the Troubles have finished?
I think I realised one day I was sitting on a beach, it was in Eastern Europe, and I said to my wife, I think I'm going to write my last book on Northern Ireland. And she said, well, what are you going to write about? And I said, I'm going to write about women because I've never done it. And nobody has ever sort of reflected the lives of women led during the Troubles, why they were very often marginalized as a force within society, and also within the paramilitaries. And I thought, well, it's about time I do it. So I sat down and began to sort of construct a concept that came out with this book, you know. And what I did was I also decided I wasn't just going to talk to people who would be victims in the sense that they're the families of people who were slaughtered. I wanted to take a look at women who were also within the paramilitaries. So I said to myself, well, you know, this is not going to be a controversial book. It's not going to be a book like The Dirty War that I wrote, where you're talking about all this nonsense and, you know, darkness and the shadows. This is going to be a very soft, gentle sort of look at the lives of those women and how they progressed over time. But certainly I find, well, I'm back into the, you know.
But for many of these women, you're talking about events 30 and 40 years ago,
yeah,
which still have left scars that haven't fully healed.
Well, you know, a lot of them have PTSD. I mean, for instance, I finished a chapter on someone I can't really name because she said to me just before the book was published, please don't include me because I really can't deal with it at the moment and the pain and the hurt, and I don't want to revisit that. And she was the widow of a very senior paramilitary figure who was also an assassin, you know. And I wanted to find out, I mean, how her life had, you know, had sort of moved on after her husband was blown up in front of her and in front of her young son. He was killed, actually, you know, in their house in the driveway. And so there are people, and a lot of other people who did talk to me are still going through this sort of trauma. They're very sensitive about, you know, the most simple and, you know, minor things. Even when you're writing this kind of book, it's not easy. I find it very difficult to write. But then, on the other hand, I mean, I was talking to Sinn Féin at one stage because they had to give someone permission, right, to talk to me, right? And I said to them, look, this book is not like The Dirty War. And they said, but all your books are like The Dirty War. And I said to them, well, you're being very Kremlin-esque, you guys, aren't you? And Sinn Féin guy said to me, well, he said, are you accusing us of censorship? I said, well, judge for yourself. And she never did. He said, I'll get back to you. They never got back to me. So she couldn't talk to me, right? This was someone who'd been a bomber, right? And that's, you know, the book in many ways, I looked at issues where I suddenly find myself back into the shadows again, looking at agents and double agents and people who were working for the state, either whether it was the Irish state or the British state. And one of the things that struck me particularly was that the women on both sides shared the same kind of conviction and the same demands. The conviction was that we've been lied to all along. The demands were that it's time to unpack all of this and to give us the truth and tell us why you haven't been able to bring anyone to justice for the crimes committed against us. And that's interesting. But I can't see any government doing it. I can't see the British government doing it because you don't know what's down there. I don't know what's down there. I know that there's a lot of very nasty stuff down there.
They don't want to ask the questions for fear of the answers that they might get when they don't know the answers. Let's take one or two particular examples. And I think for a lot of people, they will have seen Say Nothing, which is based on Patrick Radden Keefe's book, which is about the disappearance of Jean McConville. because you examine that again, and that's something you've known a lot about for a long time. And, yeah. and you don't believe the story is the way Radden Keefe has actually portrayed it, or is in his book, or is in the TV series.
Well, here's a guy who wrote a book with a 67-page index. I don't know anyone who's writing a book with a 67-page index, unless it's a reworking of the last days of the Roman Empire, or the Lost Chronicles of Cassiodorus. The thing about it is that he said, and he told America, and Disney obviously believed him, I've sort of unpacked all of this. I'm not going to give you the truth. The mystery is over, right? Well, it really wasn't. I mean, he shouldn't have called it Say Nothing. Maybe he should have said nothing, especially when it comes to this particular killing, which is really the central piece in his book, of Jean McConville, this mother that the IRA executed in a lonely grave. Now, he names someone, and I'm not going to name that person because I don't have any proof that that person was actually at the grave. I know there were three people. I can name McClure, who was a shooter. I can name Dolores, right?
Price. Dolores Price, yeah.
But I can't name the other woman. There was another woman there at that graveside. And also, he said there was only one shooter. I was told there were the three of them, right, fired, so that not one of them would be regarded as the actual killer. And the way sort of firing squads are given dud bullets or whatever, but the three of them had guns. Now, I also don't know if the Garda ever found any forensics at that grave or within the remains to suggest that there were three shooters. I don't even know that. But what Keefe didn't know when he wrote his book Say Nothing and made the Disney series was that there were three other people there when Jean McConville was executed.
The grave diggers.
Three grave diggers. And one of them was a Garda informant. Now, he is later exposed as an informant. And within the IRA, when someone's exposed as an informant, we know what happens to them, right? Somebody puts a hood over their head and they're shot. Or as the people like Scabatici would have called, they give them a headshot, right? He was allowed to go to America and start a new life because his father was a senior figure in the IRA. Now, people said to me, well, then the Garda knew where Jean McConville for all these decades was buried and knew who was involved. And I said, be cautious here, be careful. You got to do due diligence because handlers will tell you that agents are never very reliable. Sometimes they're very unreliable. So the handler of this guy who was at that graveside or the handlers may not have been told by him about the killing at all. He may not have revealed it. But the one thing we know that he was allowed to leave the IRA and go off to America.
Do you think, is it important to be accurate about things like the Say Nothing documentary? Would you fear that that gives people a wrong impression as to what happened? Or do you actually have to be utterly faithful to the truth because you still are telling the overall story, which is horrifying?
I think you have to be as close to the truth as possible. Because, you're talking about a very important piece of history. If this is so important that Disney's going to spend millions creating a sort of film around it, a series around it, then it really has to be accurate. Now, I don't know how he came up with his sort of theory of who that shooter was, except that he offers a very convoluted reason within the book where he talks about the fact that Jerry Adams was going to hire a driver and all this kind of stuff, and that driver could have been such and such. I mean, I didn't really understand what he was about at all. But the one thing he didn't know there were three other people there watching these proceedings.
There was another story in the book which really fascinated me. Why did you pick on the murder of Caroline Moreland?
This is one that really sort of shocked me. I said to myself, here was the end. Here was the end of the war. Adams and McGuinness, right, are calling an end to this. They were very prominent. I mean, John Major once sent David Davis to go to dinner with me because they wanted to know if they could do a deal with Adams. And I told them, yes, you can do a deal with Adams, but you're going to have to bring along McGuinness because McGuinness is going to have to keep Adams alive if people decide that they don't want to end the war. So you have this situation where this woman, right, who's an informant, has been forced to become an informant for Special Branch stroke MI5, because that's how the intelligence community worked with a lot of the agents that they hired. she was within the sort of the, that whole mix in West Belfast of the IRA, the provost. And just before they call an end to the war, they take her down the country, make her kneel down, they shoot her through the head.
And she was a young mother as well.
I mean, what threat was she to them at that point? I mean, they'd already sort of forgiven Scabatici, otherwise known as Steak Knife. He's just one Steak Knife. There was an operation and everybody thinks he's a Steak Knife, but the actual operation was called Steak Knife. There are a lot of Scabaticis within that operation. So they let him go loose. And what do? They take Carolyn Morland and they shoot her. Now, she had, one of the things that I didn't know until I was writing the book, she had a secret lover who was a very senior figure in the IRA. Now, it occurred to me, and this is just speculative, so I have to be careful. I don't know, and that's why I state that it's speculative, is that she may have, through pillow talk, learned an awful lot about the leadership of the IRA at that time, at a very critical time when they were about to sort of do a deal with the British. The other possibility is they decided to shoot her before they called the peace as a warning to the rank and file. In other words, if you screw with us, this is what happens to you. We are not going away. In other words, we still retain the potential to deal with informers in this kind of fashion. So those are the two options. But I don't think really it was justifiable for McGuinness. And I know that McGuinness was one of the people who made the decision to have her executed, to kill this poor woman when the war is just about over. And they're about to sign the peace, as it were, right? So it was one that really struck me forcibly as a case I had to look at, just the way I looked at sort of the Gibraltar thing also.
With Mairead Farrell. Because what interests me as well, something you said earlier, was there a sort of almost a patriarchal society in all of these groups in the North involved in terrorism, that it was nearly always led by men, made up of men, the occasional woman, but the woman was also supposed to know her place.
Yeah, misogyny was, was at a very, very high level within the IRA. I mean, you had coming among the women's side of the movement, but they were always, sort of shoved to the side. The things they did would have been to pick up weapons after an operation or to collect weapons for an operation, to hide weapons, to go and do surveillance. But they were never given the same kind of status, whatever. I mean, with Mairead Farrell, for instance, who ends up being executed by the SAS in Gibraltar, when she has her own hunger strike, she almost dies in hunger strike. And it's not really mentioned. The IRA doesn't even recognize her. And she almost died. And she ran the hunger strike. She was a young woman. She became the leader of the female wing of the IRA in Armagh prison. And she gets out and everybody says, look, you've done your piece. I mean, what you should do now is go to discos because you love dancing and whatever. And she goes back and she works for Sinn Féin. But someone decided that Farrell, who was such a prominent figure on all intelligence files, along with Daniel McCann, who was a serious operative who'd been on the Belfast Brigade at one stage, to send this team of three to Gibraltar with all of the surveillance that, going in and out of this country, going into Spain, because they were going to sacrifice them. And that's what I was told. McGuinness, after they were killed and their bodies brought back and the IRA talking about their sort of heroes, McGuinness said, I'm going to have an inquiry, right, to find out how this operation was blown. Nobody saw any document from that inquiry, so-called inquiry. I don't think he had.
Sorry, does that suggest that it in some respects suited the IRA's purpose to have martyrs?
It did in a way. It did. The one thing that struck me about this was that this operation was betrayed at a very early stage. I mean, for instance, when McGuinness decides he's going to investigate why it was blown, who does he put on the team to investigate it? Scabatici. Right. One of the leading agents, British agents in the IRA. So, yeah, I mean, the point you make is a very interesting one, that, did it suit the IRA to have people like that slaughtered? I don't think it was for that reason. I think they were set up because they were a problem. I think they were a problem within the IRA. For instance, Daniel McCann, the operation was called, by the SAS, it was called Flavius. Flavius in Latin meaning blonde, and he was 6'1", blonde. Used to work at his father's butcher shop in the Falls, very well liked. But as a young man, I mean, he was a serious IRA operative. He actually should never have been, some of the IRA leaders said to me later, he should never have been in operation anywhere. because he's too well known. And so why did they do it? Why did they send them out there?
Something else, just Martin, while we have time, about the role of women as enablers. And what I mean by that is that they may not have been involved with the likes of the UDA or the IRA or various other groups, but they were aware of what men they loved were doing, be they husbands or sons or fathers, and they turned a blind eye to it or helped or assisted.
Well, I think that was the kind of the tribalism and the historical sort of dimensions of the society itself, that women had always been, you know, loyal to, you know, the organization, loyal to romantic republicanism in whatever form it took. Within the UDA, there wasn't really the same effort. I mean, it didn't have a female wing like the IRA.
No, there's no Mairead Farrells or Dolores Prices for loyalism, is there?
Side, because there's no history there of women's involvement with loyalism.
But you have stories like Tracy Coulter, which I was very interested
in. Yeah, well, she's a 16-year-old who marries one of the UDA's leading assassins. And her father is a brigadier in the UDA. And he's frightened of this new husband this guy she's about to marry, who ends up beating her, and nobody can really stop him.
But doesn't that tell you something, that her father realised that this guy was no good for his daughter and a thug, and was happy enough to work with him in the UDA for other reasons?
He also admired him. I said to her at one stage, you know, look, I mean, your father was scared for you, and he wanted these beatings that you were taking to stop. And he even spoke to Johnny Adair, who was another thug, right, who ran the Sikh company in the Shankill, to try and get Adair to lean in this guy to say, stop beating this young woman who's your wife, you know, Tracy. And the father couldn't do a thing about it. And yet the father liked, I said, Tracy, why did he actually like the guy? He said, well, he admired him. So what did they admire about him? What did he admire about him? He admired the fact that he was called Two Gun, and he killed probably, I don't know, maybe 12, 13, 14, 15 people, you know. He was a thug too. I mean, at the end of the day, of course, he dies after he's become a kind of a drug addict, you know.
It's fascinating stuff. There is so much more in it. Unfortunately, I don't have more time at this stage.
Okay.
The book is called The Sorrow and the Loss, The Tragic Shadow Cast by the Troubles and the Lies of Women. Martin Dillon, thank you so much for taking the time.
It's been a pleasure.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.